So I'm going to present my book in two parts. So one part of the course race is a genetics microbiology with Ivan Matic. Ivan Matic in his lab. And so I'm going to present some stuff that are the first of their link to what he said, what he presented. And then now I'm also a theoretician, but now Michael asked me to make a presentation on something new, so I finished analyzing the data yesterday night. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be about sequence. I'm involved in several projects in sequence whole genome, trying to see what's going on in adaptation. And so in those cases, we have some genomics. So the first part I want to talk about, that's an introduction somehow to why experimental evolution is interesting. And so it's work that's been done in the lab with Eric Delamere, who's a head of the lab, and different people. And so the idea is that, okay, we use E. coli, and E. coli is a common source of vertebrates, the basic part of vertebrates and birds also, vertebrates. But they also pass through secondary environments. But it's also a versatile pathogen, which is because it's also involved in lots of different diseases, from HIV meningitis to septicemia to urinary tract infection to diarrhea that you may have. Experiments when traveling, and it's killing basically like 1 million. Extraintestinal disease will kill approximately 1 million people a year, and diarrhea used to kill 1 million people a year, but maybe less now, and maybe more than 100 million people a year go to the hospital or hospitalized because of E. coli. So it's not just the cloning bacteria; it's a pretty nasty one. It's in the top 5, top 10 worst pathogen. And so what we followed is that we took like 19 different infections due to E. coli, extra-intestinal infection, and there we sampled several clones within those infections, and we tried to see what's going on at the genetic diversity that we can see here. And what we could see is that in age, we did like different methods to see if there's any diversity at the genetic level, like post-genetic electrophoresis and stuff like this, or early PCR, and in 8 patients we couldn't find any sign of diversity. In 7, we find some microheterogeneity, meaning there's a single clone of E. coli infect, but then there's like some microheterogeneity emerging. In 3, there's like 2 different clones, clearly, and in another one, even 3. And in those ones, always there's one in which we see some microdiversity and the other one less. And the idea is that those infections tend to be closer to the digestive tract, meaning that the E. coli has been able to pass in larger populations. So, then we wanted to know what's this diversity, and one thing that interests us is like antibody resistance. And you can see that within a patient, you can have like different level of resistance. So same clone invaded is at the origin of the infection, but you can find that this is an antibiotic, okay, and you see that here there's no growth of the bacteria, so the bacteria is sensitive, but here it's resistant. Those two clones are within the same infection. Okay, so that there's big diversity on antibiotic resistance that emerge. And this, when we compare to the healthy patient, we find that we find more diversity, in which case we have 2 different antibiotic profiles, even 2 patients, and we have 4 different profiles of antibiotic resistance. While in a healthy patient, we wouldn't find such a high diversity. So it seems to be increased, this diversity seems to be increased in infections. And the molecular basis of that would be plasmid losses, of course. You have those plasmids that provide resistance, and also some change in permeability. So we did that in Stumferency, and he's like just measuring when you find that the resistance to antibiotic is also linked to resistance to SDS. So it means that you have change in permeability.
What's SDS?
SDS is like soap, if you want. So it's going to kill the cells. And so if you just put a little bit of them, and if they're more permeable, it's going to destroy the cells. So then another thing that matters in terms of fitness is, you know, the strain is growth rate. And so these are different strains that have been isolated within a patient. And you can see drastically different growth curves. Okay. And so we tried to also, we found this kind of diversity in growth rate, but also find much more in the infection than in the gut of the people. And then we tried to look at the different phenotypes that we had, and actually this is like the different strains of the same patient, and this is the ability to use different kind of sugars. Okay, so you can see that they're completely different. They evolve as completely different in the way they use sugars. They can change the motility. This is a bacteria that's not motile. but this one is able to move around.
Sorry, can I interrupt? So the growth rates were measured in vitro?
Yeah, that's measured in vitro.
In which way?
That was in LB, I guess.
LB, so yeah. Nothing related to the host?
No, nothing related to the host. Just that. Just to get some ideas. This is also the survival to H2O2, and you can see also that they differ a lot. And actually, all these kind of phenotypes are linked to the global search response that Ivan introduced Monday, the RPOS, and we could, by Western blot, find different level of RPOS in those lines. And then when we correlate all the, we do like proteomics on those strains, and a bunch of phenotypes, and we find that there's massive correlation in two clusters in Irish. One is linked to stress response, the other one to the ability to use materials. Okay? And this is what Ivan told you about a little bit also, is the trade-off between that conference called Self-Preservation and Nutritional Competence Trade-off. And it's like, you have to fight between high resistance, between the level of resistance and your efficiency to use nutrients. And the idea is that if you have a high rate, if you have a higher permeability, for instance, you have a higher efficiency to get to obtain nutrients, but at a cost because you're less sensitive to stress. Okay? And then the other way, if you overexpress the stress response, you tend to be much more resistant to stress, but then the effect is that you shut down the doors to avoid stress, and then you're unable to use lots of nutrients. We sequence some of the genomes, and what we find out is that all the strains differ. You know, this infection lasted for a few weeks, okay? And within all the strains differ by 1, 2, 3 mutations, okay? There's no clustering of the strains, meaning that's like a radiation. So in some cases, we have 2 mutations, I don't know where they are, but 2 mutations in the home A occurred independently, 2 different mutations. We have one, it's a frame shift in the terminus part. The other one is like a point mutation in sequence. So home A is a foreign, so involved in the permease. But we see a large radiation, many changes occurring. Some of the genes involved here have an effect on the stress response when we measure it. When we measure it in some lab strains, you can activate this gene in the lab strain. They never been described as being part of this network. So what we're finding is that the network should be presumably massive, because there are many ways in which you can change a gene that's linked very vaguely to this network, and in cascade, it's changing these phenotypes, the way you perceive stress and all these. So the idea is that this radiation is possible because we have a large mutational target, and so many mutations can make changes, and then selection can be fast in sorting out those mutants.
Sorry, can you explain what this graph means?
It's just a tree. So we use all the different phenotypes of the strains, okay, to make a neighbor joining tree, and then we put the different mutations, but just to show the diversity in the phenotype that they have and the mutations. So it's just to
so this is in phenotype space then?
Mm-hmm. That's the phenotype. That's the phenotype tree, and then we have the mutation that when we sequence the genomes, the mutation that we found.
But you're saying that all of them differ by one mutation?
They differ by 1, 2 mutations. When we sequence just 4 of them, and 1 out of 3 a mutation, but 1 was a neutral one, and so that's 2 mutation, it's very few events. It's 1, 2.
These are all the strains from all the individuals?
Sorry?
All the strains from all the individuals?
No, these are 1 patient.
One
patient, the diversity, the microdiversity that emerged with 1 patient. Now we have others, characterizing others. But in all the patients, we find linked to this RPOS network that emerged. So the idea is that in all these different patients, we have some diversity emerging very rapidly, and this diversity seems to be mostly specific of the infection, because we don't find such a high diversity within the digestive tract.
Can you say a bit more about what's your phenotypic space and what do you?
I mean, it's not. It's just a tree. It's not a phenotypic space here. It's just like we have like all these different phenotypes that we measure. Okay, with proteomics, we measure.
So you measure them. So you have some list of numbers for each strain.
Yeah.
So what are the numbers? I guess is my question.
Oh, here's like, for this, it would be like this H2O2 sensitivity would be the points that here, the survival to H2O2 here, that would be 1 and 3, the ability to use different sugars, that would be the, for all the points below, these are proteomics, we quantify the number of proteins in the different strains, and so this is just like a...
So it what's the dimension of that space, roughly?
Oh, we haven't measured that thing as well.
No, but I mean, you have a list of numbers, right?
Yeah, we have a list of numbers. It's a few hundred phenotypes.
A few hundred numbers.
Yeah.
And then this is a PCA that you show in
it? It's not a PCA. It's a neighbor joining tree using those stuff.
No, the previous one.
The proteomics.
Yeah. Well, that's just the tree. That's just the tree where Humanis did that. It's just a multi-dimensional scaling that he did.
So for each of the strains, you have a list of proteins that you see whether they're expressed or not.
Yeah. But I mean, that's not going to the detail of that. It's just to show that we have a big diversity emerging within a globe, within an infection very rapidly, and that this diversity is linked dominantly to regulon, which is the stress response regulon. Okay, and then this kind of diversity has been seen in vitro, in test tubes. Okay, in chemostat, some parents saw that. You can see a lot of diversity emerging in response to that stress response. So that's where I tried to tell you that there's some similarity between what's going on in a test tube and what's going on in an infection. And one of the reasons is that we have plenty of different phenotypes that we see that have been measured. People are very excited about measuring all these interactions, like cheatings, cross-feeding between strains that you can see in the lab occurring. And one of the reasons we may be able to see those in an infection is that within an infection, E. coli is interacting with E. coli dominantly, and then the organism host. In the digestive tract, E. coli is a minority species. It's interacting 1 in 1,000. There's like at least 1,000 more other bacteria than E. coli in the tube. So most of the other partners to E. coli are not E. coli. They're just like other species. Okay, and so when it's comes the idea that when it's producing an infection, everything's open and free to him to diversify. Because now we have access to plenty of resources that in the digestive tract, hey, you have that's thing or whatever, you say, hey, don't worry, that's my job here. I use those resources, okay, much more efficient in using those that you are. But when you go out, when you go in the blood, when you go in those pus and everything like this, now it's an opportunity for plenty of new opportunities arise. And so we can see this kind of diversification, presumably within the infection, but not seen in the digestive tract. And so presumably what we do in test tubes may be more similar than what's going within an infection than what's going in the digestive tract, where the dominant interaction is with all the species that really constrain the niche you can occupy. While all the waste that E. coli is producing are going to be used by other species. While in the test tube, those wastes are here. So it's very easy to adapt to those, and we have all the work by Michael Doherty, working that you can see that cross-feeders we use. Plenty of different strategies can emerge, but they are not that beneficial in the gut, but they may be interesting within the course of an infection.
I have a very basic question. Do we know how many generations E. coli spend outside the gut versus in the gut?
There's some very, very rough estimates saying that it's spending 50% of its time, but this is really, with the hands on. So nobody knows. It's like, there's one paper that they recite from the late 70s, and they look at the calculations. So it's very hard to know.
So we don't know.
We don't know. It's spending some time between hosts. We know it can survive, but not that well. Though some strains are adapted to the environment better, some survive. So Gordon will tell you that in Australia there's one lake where there's some blooming of E. coli. Mm-hmm. And so usually E. coli is fecal, it's a sign of fecal pollution. So but in that lake, putting the whole Sydney population we have put in the lake on that day to at least a part of E. coli. So some strains do survive well in the environment. But you can also find them in infections sometimes. When we sample in the wild, they're eaten fairly rapidly by protozoans and everything like this. But we have no idea.
Within these infected people, how does the bacteria get out of the gut?
Oh, it depends. I mean, sometimes there's a way, from the poo to the vagina, going up, all this stuff. I mean, and then in some cases, infections. There's some translocation after you eat a good dinner, a few bacteria, you're relaxed, and a few bacteria will go into the blood. Most of the time nothing happens, but if you're less happy this day, whatever, you can find this little spot, you don't know why, and then you can make a pus coming in, and you can have deep pus that stay for months in there. So I'm not a specialist at that, but there's plenty of ways to find your way there. So they can, every other woman will make an infection to E. coli.
So where were the patient samples taken from? Not the gut?
No, not the gut. So it was infection throughout the extra-intestinal infections. And that's the one we, not the area infection. So somewhere in septicemia, urinary tract infection, some deep pus. And so, but you know, it's the first, it was the first that now we would need to do more, to control more, to sample. We tried to do experimental model of these, but that, for instance, for pus, we're actually killing a lot of the mice for nothing because it's not stable, so it's pretty awful what we're doing. So we stopped. And so it's we have some model of urinary tract infection, but it's not that stable. But the idea is to go to more control system now, or to sample more carefully and different, to have more numbers and everything to see because of the infection. But that was the first, it's one of the first where we studied the diversity of the infection before it was that nobody cared. And so now one of the questions you could ask is the impact of virulence. The impact is this. You know, if you're very microbiologist, whatever you see you think is like very useful, then it's going to lead to some more virulence because you can make more brands if you say so. And so the idea is that we've seen this diversity, presumably it's been selected for in the local environment. Now we can wonder whether it has an impact on virulence. And one way to measure that, specifically because some of the strains are very resistant to stress, so we could think that they could be resistant to macrophage. And so one thing we did is that we just, it's not a perfect model, but you inject the strains in the peritonis of the mice and see how well they behave. And usually with the strains that grow fast, usually, you know, you just give them a life expectancy of like 15 hours. They're all dead after 15 hours. And the strain that grow slower, actually, that tend to be more resistant, you know, it survive longer. And the one that grow very poorly, actually, half of the mice survive. So it means that this higher level of resistance does not seem to have virulence in that context. Okay. That's one model to test that. Same thing for antibiotic resistance. Most of the antibiotic resistance going towards sensitivity, which is good because they lose the resistance. But maybe not that good in terms of the clinical setting because most of the medical doctors will sample one colony. You know, not the doctors, but the tech will sample one colony and make the antibiogram. Okay? And in some patients, we have like five, four different antibody profiles. And if you sample this one, you say, okay, let's go with amoxicillin and treat the guy. Well, half of the population is like actually already resistant. So that can be this kind of diversity going somehow in a good direction because there's less virus and less resistance, but it can be tricky in terms of the